I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's March 12th, and we have a lot to talk about. March is MS Awareness Month, and my goal in this week's episode of the podcast is to raise your awareness of how MS can impact your vision and to introduce you to an imaging technology that's proven to be even more accurate than MRI when it comes to diagnosing MS. And I might add, it's not nearly as invasive. Dr. Shiv Sida joins me this week for a deep dive into how to best navigate MS-related vision issues, and we'll get an introduction into how optical coherence tomography, or OCT, can be used in accurately diagnosing multiple sclerosis. Dr. Sida is a professor of neurology in the Division of Neuroimmunology and Neurological Infections at Johns Hopkins Hospital. And in a moment, we'll meet my guest, Dr. Shiv Sida. As many of you know from your own experience, the very first sign of MS is often optic neuritis. Joining me to share strategies for navigating MS-related vision issues and provide some guidance for managing and optimizing your vision is Dr. Shiv Sida. Dr. Sida is a professor of neurology in the Division of Neuroimmunology and Neurological Infections at Johns Hopkins Hospital. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Sida.
Thank you, John. It's a real pleasure to be here.
So I hope you'll get us started by explaining some of the most common vision issues that people with MS might face.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think, the most kind of common visual problem that people think about is visual blurring or difficulty with actual vision itself. And so inflammation of the optic nerve or optic neuritis, it's a relevant process that occurs in a pretty large proportion of people with MS. The optic nerve is that nerve that carries signals from the eye through pathways to the back of the brain where the visual centers are located. And so inflammation of the optic nerve or optic neuritis is kind of the initial manifestation of MS in up to about 25% of people. And optic neuritis affects roughly up to 50% of people at some point during their MS disease course. And so typical symptoms of optic neuritis are usually difficulty with vision, visual blurring that develops frequently over a number of days. The visual impairment can be quite severe or quite marked. Occasionally, people can actually reach a point where they can't even see anything out of that eye. There's frequently associated pain with eye movements. But the good news is that the visual function recovery tends to actually be pretty excellent after an episode of optic neuritis, at least in the context of when it's related to MS. That being said, the kind of premise that we use for saying that visual function recovery is excellent is kind of recovery at regular or high contrast visual function. Many people who have complete recovery of their visual function at regular levels of illumination, in other words, high contrast visual function, will continue to have difficulty with vision in low levels of illumination. And we refer to this as low contrast vision. And so that's particularly evident to a person in the evening time when it's a little bit darker or during the night, for example. So the other kind of common way that MS can affect the visual system is through affecting the pathways that are involved or the signals that are involved in eye movements themselves. And so that typically manifests itself with difficulty moving in a particular eye in a direction. And the kind of clinical manifestation of that for an individual person is the experience of double vision. So there's a number of different ways that MS can affect the visual system. And it varies from one person to another.
Why is early detection important in addressing vision problems and preserving visual function for people living with MS?
So I think this is a really important question. And I think that we can probably, you know, replace the word vision in that question with literally anything, right? We could change it with motor function, bladder, bowel function, you know, sensory function, balance. And really I think the kind of important thing is arriving at an accurate diagnosis of MS as early as possible is beneficial for an individual person, because then it allows the implementation of an appropriate treatment for that individual person. Typically, our treatments or disease-modifying treatments are therapies that either modulate or suppress the immune system. And the goal of treatment is really to try to reduce or hopefully prevent, you know, further inflammatory events from occurring and further damage from occurring within the nervous system. And that really then maximizes the opportunity to hopefully try to keep people the way that they are.
Other MS symptoms can worsen over time. Can those MS-related vision issues also worsen over time? And can someone actually lose their vision due to MS?
So I think there's a number of things. So yes, there can be what we will call quote unquote progression or deterioration in different domains of the nervous system, including in the visual system among people with MS. The visual function, or I should say the visual dysfunction among people with MS, isn't typically that so severe that vision is completely lost. And I think there is a important to kind of point a number of things out here. So if somebody has an episode of optic neuritis, and yes, the degree of recovery can vary quite a bit, right? So while most people tend to have good recovery, there are some people in whom the recovery may not be good. But because it's more typical for the recovery to actually be pretty good after an episode of optic neuritis among people with MS, if somebody has an episode of optic neuritis and the visual function recovery is very poor, I think it's important, at least on the provider or clinician side, to very carefully consider whether the diagnosis of MS is correct. And I say that because there are a number of other conditions that are related and can sometimes be misdiagnosed as MS that can cause much more severe optic neuritis. And the condition really that comes to the top of my mind when I'm saying this is something called NMO or neuromyelitis optica. There's another condition called MOG associated disease, and MOG stands for myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein. And again, the visual function affliction as part of the optic neuritis can be very profound in both of those other disease states. Just in a very broad sense, in terms of preservation of things, right? I think this kind of brings me to like a topic which I think is really important. Our treatments are targeting the immune system, right? And we're trying to lower the chances of new events from occurring, right? But they're not really doing much in terms of protecting the nervous system architecture that's already, let's say, in a bit of an unhealthy state and susceptible to slowly dying. And they're not really promoting repair per se. And so really, if we want to like optimize outcomes, apart from being on the kind of like most appropriate treatment, it's extremely important to have approaches for protection, so neuroprotection, to combat neurodegeneration, and then approaches for remyelination to combat demyelination, myelin being that insulation or that's wrapped around the nerve wires or cables that nerve cells use to speak to one another. And we don't have treatments for neuroprotection and remyelination, but we have lifestyle strategies, which are extremely important. And I can't underemphasize the importance and role of diet and exercise with respect to both of these two different factors. The diet, for example, that has some of the the greatest data among people with MS is the Mediterranean style diet. But if you just look at the effect of a Mediterranean style diet in people who don't have MS, people who don't have MS and who follow a Mediterranean style diet have higher brain volumes, they have higher cognitive function, better energy levels, better mood. And then exercise, we know that there's in a dose response to exercise, you can actually see new nerve cells developing within the brains of mice, the more that they're made run on a rotowheel when you radiolabel those nerve cells, which is kind of fascinating. And there's been some studies done, such as in France, showing that, you know, the highest doses of combined aerobic and anaerobic exercise actually reduce conversion from a pre-dementia state to true clinically definite dementia by about 40% over a 5-year period. And I think, although we're not talking about dementia, I think that this data in other disease states regarding lifestyle is incredibly important. And then one other thing is that we know that outcomes among people with MS are highly influenced by other general health parameters. So it's extremely important if somebody has high blood pressure, cholesterol, or diabetes that they're as well controlled as possible, because it's well recognized and there's a wealth of literature about this, that people with MS who have vascular disease that's not well controlled, that they tend to do worse over time. Similarly, people with MS who smoke have a 2 to 3 times higher relapse rate as well. So the general lifestyle kind of like considerations and looking after general health is extremely critical from an MS point of view.
If someone living with MS is experiencing vision issues, should they see an eye doctor, their neurologist, or even a neuro-ophthalmologist?
That's a great question. And I think, you know, this is possibly one of the pitfalls in MS care, is to assume both on the provider and the individual patient side that everything that one is experiencing is due to their MS. Unfortunately, there are a lot of other things that cause visual issues. And as we get older, we're more susceptible to developing cataracts and glaucoma and a number of other kind of ophthalmologic disorders. And so I would say, and I generally tell people who see me in clinic, that I think it's pretty important to get an annual healthy eye exam with an eye doctor. That's similar to, hey, you know, it's also important to see your PCP once a year and make sure that, like, you're not missing any kind of like general health factors that could fall between the cracks, right? Stay on top of cancer screening. And then similarly, for some of the treatments, particularly some of the highly immunosuppressive therapies, important to potentially be having an annual skin check as well. So I think and then in terms of what type of eye doctor, I mean, I think that if somebody has MS, I think at least seeing just a general eye doctor once a year is extremely important.
I'm curious, are there any vision rehabilitative interventions or assistive devices that can make daily life easier for someone with MS-related vision issues?
So oftentimes the difficulty with visual issues is related to some of the damage that's occurred within the nerves, right? And so really the way to make that better is to promote repair, right? And we don't yet, but I'm super optimistic about the future that we will have repair approaches available. But at the same time, while we don't have a drug, we do have lifestyle factors. And I think exercise promotes repair, right? So, and I think this is relevant, not just to the visual system. This is just relevant across the disease itself. There aren't really, you know, let's say visual specific rehabilitation parameters that can be applied because the problem has got to do with the movement of signals, right? Occasionally, people will have heat-related worsening of their visual symptoms. And what that's referred to as kind of like Uthoff's phenomenon. But heat or exertion-related aggravation of underlying visual symptoms sometimes that might actually be amenable to the use of treatments that might help to promote an improvement in the way that some of the signals are actually being conducted through the actual nervous system itself. And so there are a number of symptomatic treatments that are available that can potentially help along those lines, although they're primarily mainly used for kind of, you know, trying to improve ambulatory or walking difficulty. Now, I think just going back to this kind of like general perspective, the one thing is to not, again, to not miss out on the opportunity for treating something that's not MS related, that's visual related, that could be contributing to the visual issues, right? Making sure that your refraction is correct, right, on your spectacles. Again, that requires having to see somebody, you know, once a year to make sure that actually that particular prescription is appropriate and adequate. Again, making sure that there's nothing else developing, right, in terms of like any other, you know, kind of comorbidities that could be affecting the eyes as well. I will say one other common thing that we commonly get asked is in the clinic is, particularly as people get a little bit older, and as they kind of get into their 40s, people will sometimes say, oh, you know, my MS is starting to affect my vision. I'm starting to have difficulty with seeing things that are up close. And unfortunately, that has nothing to do with their MS either, right? So there is a thing called presbyopia, which is a normal aging related phenomenon where through changes in the kind of like shape of the eye, that people start to have some difficulty with like reading. And that that can sometimes be amenable to, again, to, you know, refraction to try and like improve that too.
I know you recently co-authored research on socioeconomic disparity and its association with faster retinal neurodegeneration in multiple sclerosis. What did you learn in conducting your research?
Well, this was a great study. This in the, you know, led by a colleague of mine, Kate Fitzgerald. It was a pretty large study. There was about 800 people with MS in this study. What was found was that people who were more disadvantaged, right? In other words, they had kind of low, what we can describe as kind of like lower socioeconomic capacity, that they had faster rates of tissue loss within their retinas. And you might say, well, and this is interesting because we also know, for example, that what happens in the eye actually is reflecting what happens in the brain. I mean, so through my own research, we've shown that rates of change within the eye itself is reflecting rates of change throughout the central nervous system, right? And so you can kind of get a window into what's happening in the brain through the eye. And so you might say, well, so what was the reason that we looked at the retina in this study? And that's the reason, because, and it's accessible, right? And it's easy. And we're using a tool called OCT or optical coherence tomography, which is easy to repeat, and it's very well tolerated, and it's very reproducible. I think one of the lessons is, you know, why, right? And that's not, that might sound like not a lesson, but a question. But I think that it does raise questions about why does the level of advantageness or disadvantageness feed into outcomes among people with MS? And I don't know, and actually nobody really fully knows, but we do have a very strong awareness of the role and relevance of general kind of lifestyle factors influencing overall outcomes among people with MS. And like I said, people with MS who have poorly controlled diabetes or high blood pressure, cholesterol, they don't do as well over time. Vascular disease occurs in the brain just as much as it occurs in other parts of the body. And when vascular disease occurs in the brain of somebody with MS, it's like throwing oil in on top of a fire, so to speak. Similarly, MS patients who smoke have worse outcomes generally over time. There's also it's also kind of similar to to BMI, very non-specific body mass index, right? It's not really a very specific measurement, but people who have higher BMI, and actually this is a study that I'd published in the past, was looking at about 500 people who attend our center. People with higher BMI, regardless of the potency of the treatment that they're on, that they tended to have faster rates of retinal tissue loss as well. And there's also been a colleague of mine, Dr. Ellen Mowry, who's shown that people with higher BMI have faster rates of brain tissue loss over time. So the influence of lifestyle factors is extremely important. But and then just to come back to the socioeconomic kind of like disparities, you know, there's socioeconomic disparity, and then I think we sometimes make the mistake of synonymizing this with other factors. But I think another factor that's relevant is race. Now we have, and I've published a paper with Peter Calabresi in the past showing that people with MS who attend our center, we had about 115 Black American patients and 115 White American patients. We tracked with brain and retinal or eye scans over a period of several years. And again, Black individuals tended to have faster amounts of both eye and brain tissue loss over time. And so there's a number of individual things that go beyond just what we kind of like can measure. And some of it as well, we even know, for example, that men, for example, tend to do worse over time with MS as well. So I think the learning point is to be very vigilant about trying to maximize the opportunity for just general health in just from a broad perspective in terms of the management of MS. I would say make one other comment about Kate Fitzgerald's study on the socioeconomic disparity. And that is that people who are more disadvantaged, it's kind of akin, it's interesting. So they were much more likely to be escalated to more potent or higher potency therapies, and yet their outcomes were a little bit worse. And there's actually been some recent data, for example, showing that even sometimes, and by the way, race, it's much more complicated than white and black, because also we know, for example, that people of Hispanic origin also tend to do worse over time in people with MS. But then we don't actually fully understand how that translates in other countries and geographic regions. And so it's a really complicated area. It's interesting that more recently, there's actually been some studies done showing that Black Americans, as an example, some of them, despite even having faster diagnosis of MS, and this is very kind of newish data, that they still have worse outcomes. So faster diagnosis, faster treatment, and still worse outcomes. And so the race side of things is fascinating, but and we don't really fully understand it. So that's why I when you said what was the lesson, I answered it by saying it was a question.
You know,
and again, my question is always why.
Well, a moment ago, I heard you say that what's happening in the eye is indicative of what's happening in the brain, that the optic nerve is sort of a window into what's happening in our central nervous system. So with that, with that in mind, it's been observed that thinning of the retinal nerve fiber occurs in people with MS, regardless of what other symptoms they may or may not be experiencing. What might that mean when it comes to diagnosing MS and perhaps even being predictive of disease progression?
Wow. So first of all, where we can get, I love the question. So there is, you mentioned the retinal nerve fiber layer, right? And we have to explain what the retinal nerve fiber layer is. It's abbreviated RNFL. But basically, it's the top layer of the retina. But I don't know if you know this, actually, John, but you probably do, but it's actually fascinating. The retina is an unmyelinated central nervous system structure. The retina contains no, it's in under normal situations, only in pathological states is there myelin present. There shouldn't be myelin. Why would you want myelin in your retina? Because it's just going to block the movement of light, right? So anyway, that top layer of the retina is composed of the axons or cables that are derived from the neurons called ganglion cell neurons that sit beneath it. And they sweep across the retina and they coalesce at the disc, the optic disc, and where they form the optic nerve, and then they exit the eye going backwards, and it's only behind the eye that then they're then applied with myelin. Okay, so the ganglion cell there, which contains the nerve cells from which those axons or nerve fibers are derived, that can actually be very reliably and reproducibly measured with OCT, even perhaps better than the ornithol. If we take that neuronal there, it's actually abbreviated GCIPL, which stands for ganglion cell interplexiform layer. So it's normally a composite of two different layers. The intervisit intraclass correlation coefficient, which is a scientific way of saying how reproducible something is close to one, right? And one is the best score you can get. It's 0.99. And to take your second question first, what has been shown is that people who have a GCIPL thickness below a certain threshold, that over a 10-year period of time, that they're more likely to accumulate disability, right? It's also been shown that people who have a thickness below a certain amount are more likely to go on, and this was a German study that was led by Alexander Brandt when he was at Charité in Berlin, they're more likely to go on from what we call CIS, which is the first initial manifestation of MS or clinically isolated syndrome, to clinically definite MS. So in other words, it may have some predict, not just disability predictive utility, but also predicting outcome. Now, let's go back then for a minute to the first question, because this is super relevant. So optic neuritis is the initial manifestation of people in about 20 people with MS in about 25% of cases. But if you look at the optic nerves at post-mortem in people with MS, up to 99% of them, so basically almost everybody, have got demyelinating plaques in their optic nerves. In other words, optic nerve pathology or involvement is occurring in the vast majority of people with MS, whether they are aware of it or not. And that provides a very unique opportunity, because involvement of the optic nerve on one side and not really on the other side will lead to what's called asymmetry or discrepancy in the eye measurements. And so it has been shown that intra-eye asymmetry, so a difference in the thicknesses of the GCIPL between both eyes, is a very sensitive way for picking up optic nerve involvement. And that if you, and there have been a number of studies, and I'm going to kind of bucket them together, but one was from somebody called Gabriel Basté in Vienna, and another one from somebody called Olivia Eiteruck in France. And if you take this intra-eye asymmetry and then you play with it, and I'm going to put that very loosely, what does play with it mean, right? So our current diagnostic criteria for MS, we have two compartments, right? We've got dissemination in space and time. But for dissemination in space, we're looking for lesions in two out of four areas. And I don't want to get bogged down in the too much on the nitty-gritty of it, but none of those four areas is the optic nerve, okay? So what if you add the optic nerve as a fifth topography, right? So now you go two out of five. And so what they showed and what has been found is that you can increase the ability to accurately, with specificity, and I want to come back to the specificity thing in a second, with specificity, improve your diagnostic capacity for MS, predicting that somebody who presents for the very first time will either go on to clinically definite MS or to McDonald MS, which is the current diagnostic criteria. And why do I mention specificity? Because MRI is super sensitive. We have really sensitive tests, but what we are missing in gray zones where we're not really totally sure about what the diagnosis is specificity. And so OCT with intra-eye asymmetry thresholds could actually add a lot more specificity if it was to be, for example, considered for inclusion as part of diagnostic criteria.
Well, I think you may be accurately predicting the future there, and certainly hope so, because I think what every single person who is undergoing the process of being diagnosed for MS, what they're looking for is specificity. Dr. Shiv Sida, thank you for all you do to improve the lives of people living with MS, and thanks so much for talking with me today.
Not at all. Thank you so much for having me, John. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society, and you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/341. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.